We got a bad enough reputation out there as it is. I won't.
Kira forced a smile.
After all, you don't seem to mind. Yeah, well, I personally think those people are just full of shit.
The elf scowled.
Those fanatics are all dirty old men, you know. Just pigs who want women to serve as baby factories and nothing else. Do elves struggle with having kids that much? I mean, there are a lot more humans than elves around, so... That is most certainly not the case. We're not any less fertile than humans or dwarves, you know. It's just that we're more in control of our lower halves. Really? That's not the impression I got from Rowie. Kira! What? Too much information.
Part 4. The door to Ruana's humble abode swung open, and Kira walked through it with her usual, carefree grin.
Honey, I'm home!
She called out in a cheerful voice.
You don't need to shout so loud, Kira!
The elf protested from her seat at the desk.
I'm right here, you know. Oh, come on. Is that any way to greet me?
The elf sighed, then put on a tired smile.
Welcome back, sweetie.
Those three simple words were all Kira wanted to hear. She nodded with a satisfied expression and closed the door behind her, then walked up to Ruana.
More paperwork?
She asked, pointing at a small stack.
Yeah. Apparently, there was an outbreak of snake-eyed nearby restaurant, so we got swamped with patients suffering from tunnel vision. It really strained our supplies at the clinic, so I'm writing up requisition orders.
The 19-year-old elf was an alchemist who worked as an apothecary and physician. Open wounds and fractured bones could easily be patched up with healing magic, but persistent problems such as rashes, diseases, and toothaches were best dealt with by applying the right poultice or elixir. Her wages were a bit low since she was technically still an apprentice, but it was nevertheless a steady job that involved helping people, which was everything Ruana wanted. She could do with less paperwork, but that was inevitable with government jobs.
Sounds rough,
Kira commented.
Not as rough as you've had it, apparently. You positively reek of sweat. Ugh, don't remind me. I'm gonna go wash up.
Okay,
the elf said while stretching her stiff back.
I'll get dinner ready while you do that. Steamed salmon, right? Yep. I got a good deal for it at the market earlier. It's super fresh, too. Oh, right!
The cat girl bounced off towards the rear of the house and went down a narrow staircase into the cellar. She quickly took off her gear, threw it into a pile in the corner, and went into the small bathroom. It was literally carved into the magical hilt tree's bark, much like the rest of the cellar. A small magic lamp dangled from the ceiling to provide ample light while Kira filled the wooden tub with hot water and started washing herself off. Being able to leisurely take a bath in one's own home, even one as small as this, was a luxury that only those living in the capital could enjoy. The handmade scented soaps and shampoos, on the other hand, were some of the perks of living with an alchemist. Kira emerged from the cellar 20 minutes later wearing a plain tunic and trousers, courtesy of Ruana. She found that, much to her delight, a plate of piping hot, bright red steamed salmon fillets was waiting for her. The elf set out another serving for herself, and the two sat down to eat and chat about their days.
But then he slipped on some bird poop and fell off the branch.
Or at least that's what the elf intended, but Kira's way of explaining things turned every meal into a surprisingly boisterous one. The lively gesturing, random arm flailing, and excited tail wagging that accompanied her tales were completely devoid of manners or coherence.
Oh my, I hope the poor lad didn't hurt himself.
Ruana quite enjoyed that unrestrained side of her, though. The beastkin girl's hyperactive, overtly animated explanations were quite endearing. Not to mention entertaining.
I thought he was going to get injured, too,
continued Kira.
But Mr. Fayhorn managed to save him with an amazing power shot. I didn't even see the arrow in flight.
She had the power to make even the dullest, most mundane event seem much more exciting than it actually was.
One moment it was on his bow, and the next thing I knew it had already pierced Jeremy's collar and had pinned him to the side of the tree. Oh, he's a good guy after all, isn't he? I told you he was.
The cat girl finished her story and ate the piece of salmon that had been on her fork for the past few minutes. The way she waved it around sent juices flying everywhere. Even if it was messy and noisy, Rowana much preferred this lively atmosphere rather than the lonely, depressing evenings she had gotten used to.
So good!
Kira let out a few squeals of delight as she happily chewed on the delicious fish, then swallowed it with an audible gulp. She then put another piece of meat into her mouth and resumed.
So anyway, that's when the instructor decided to call it quits for the day. Since everyone was starting to lose focus, he even let me ride the cart on the way back since I did a good job today. And then... ah.
The cat girl suddenly stopped speaking and cast her eyes downward.
Kira, what's wrong?
There was a short pause before Kira swallowed her mouthful, then brought up the issue that she had been made aware of earlier that afternoon.
I wish you would have told me about the Nairi thing. You found out about that after all,
Rowana said glumly.
So it's true? There are selfish people out there that wouldn't approve of our relationship?
I'm afraid so.
The elf cast her eyes downward and took a deep sigh.
I'm sorry. I know I should have told you right away. But you're just so cheerful and easygoing that I was afraid I might scare you off, so I couldn't bring myself to tell you.
Rowana had wanted to tell her about this the moment they confirmed they had feelings for each other. But the words got stuck in her throat like a lump. She just couldn't manage to bring that heavy topic up.
Then... the real reason you don't want to go out on dates or even hold hands in public is because of that? Yes.
Of course, she understood this was a terrible, selfish decision. But part of her just wanted to pretend her homophobic countrymen didn't exist. Not to mention she had no idea how that hyperactive girl might react.
Oh, thank goodness!
Exclaimed Kira.
What?
Okay. She may have had some ideas about her reaction, but a relieved, thank goodness, was definitely not among them.
I thought maybe you were ashamed of being seen with me or something like that. So that's why you kept making excuses. That's definitely not it. I'd love nothing more than to show the world how much you mean to me. It's just that...
You're worried about someone tearing us apart by force.
Yeah.
The elf sighed after a short pause. Being harassed by strangers was one thing, but Rowana's parents were a much bigger obstacle. The Slythe household had always been bogged down by tradition, so there was no chance that her mother and father would approve of the relationship. She hadn't even told them of her orientation, for fear of what they might do. It was also why she insisted she move out and learn to live independently at such a young age. As if distancing herself from the issue would somehow make it go away. Things obviously hadn't worked out that way.
I see.
The cat girl crossed her arms with a serious look on her face.
Then I must take some rather extreme measures.
Extreme measures?
Rowana raised an eyebrow.
That's right. Don't you worry one bit, for I have come up with a brilliant, foolproof plan to fix this.
You did you?
The cat girl's relentlessly cheerful attitude was steadily infecting Rowana, drawing out both a smile and a chuckle.
I'll just become the best damned adventurer there ever was!
And how does that fix anything?
If I become famous and strong enough, then nobody would dare get in our way. Anyone stupid enough to try to ruin our relationship would be sent running for the hills with just a glare from yours truly.
It was outlandish, childish, and unrealistic reasoning. But the sheer conviction with which she said it almost made Rowana believe. Of course, even if the outrageous, best damned adventurer title was a thing that existed, she doubted it would be enough to overcome centuries worth of culture and tradition. Admittedly, the elves' homophobia was nowhere near as bad as it used to be during the time of the Elven Dominion, but the Ishigar Republic that rose up to replace it had a ways to go yet.
And if anyone dares to lay a finger on you, then I'll send them flying with a single hit.
My, my, is that so?
However, rather than rain on her parade, Rowana just happily accepted Kira's feelings.
It is, and then we can be lovey-dovey all we want, wherever we want.
Is the current level of lovey-dovey not enough for you?
Rowana leaned in closer to Kira as she spoke in a sultry voice. Their faces were so close to each other that their noses almost touched.
I mean, well...
A suddenly flustered catgirl stammered. She reflexively leaned back a bit as her eyes darted all over the place.
It's just that I...
The elf suddenly threw her arms around Kira's neck and sealed those thin, chocolatey lips with her own. The beastkin's eyes widened in surprise for a brief moment before she eagerly returned both the embrace and the kiss. Both of them moaned quietly as their tongues entwined around each other. Rowana pulled her face away from her lovers after about a minute, licking and smacking her lips as she did so.
Lovey-dovey enough for you?
She whispered.
Could use a little more. Then shall we move on to the main event?
The two of them got up from the table and made their way towards the bed while kissing and caressing each other, whereupon Rowana thoroughly worshipped the smaller girl's body. What Leah had said earlier that day regarding her people's biology was no lie. The knife-eared elves had no trouble conceiving children. It was just that their libido and desire to have offspring were quite subdued. Rowana had been like that as well, regardless of her sexual preference. She, of course, felt attracted to beautiful women, but never outright lusted after them. She also knew that her people's naturally weak sex drive was often a strain on cross-species couples. She was worried it would negatively affect her own relationship with the more primal beastkin girl. However, such fears were almost immediately shattered, as there was something about Kira that sent Rowana's passions ablaze like nothing else could. Although the elf didn't want to openly admit it, the most likely cause for this was her own nose. Her sense of smell had always been strangely acute, which was vital for an alchemist since the fumes of a potion in progress often gave clues as to how well the brewing process was going. The elf's sharp sense of smell was then further amplified by her perception attribute as she gained job and skill levels, and currently rivaled that of high-leveled rangers. It also had the side effect of making her thoroughly aware of Kira's scent when they first met. And she smelled good. It wasn't as if Rowana had a vulgar habit of sniffing others, though. It was just that the animalistic musk of the young catgirl drifted into her nostrils all on its own. It was completely unlike anyone or anything else she had ever smelled before, and it had the curious effect of waking up the elf's wild side. Tonight was no different. In fact, the elf had been in the mood pretty much ever since her lover came back stinking of sweat, and had planned on devouring her girlfriend throughout their entire dinner. She wasn't sure whether this strangely arousing scent was due to some trait of the beastkin species, or whether she might secretly be a pervert, or perhaps even a bit of both, but none of that mattered to her at this point. The only thing that did was that this phenomenon allowed her and her lover to share their joy in carnal bliss with enviable frequency. Their compatibility was so good that the elf almost felt like they were made for each other. It was as if their meeting a little over a week ago was fate. Although others might call this a naive or childish notion, those people could go suck on a lemon for all she cared. While the two lovebirds steadily worked on staining Rowana's bedsheets for the umpteenth time, another pair of women were also getting busy in their own way. Namely, Zira and Cora, who at the time were roughly 200 meters below the young couple's love nest. They were still busy searching the old decrepit sewers under Azure Vale for a good spot to establish their master's lair, and had just made an interesting discovery.
Master, we found a group of R.O.U.S. down here,
reported the succubus. This section of the underground maze was much more spacious than the rest of it, much to Cora's relief. It was shaped like an upside-down half-pipe that was nearly as wide as a street. The middle of it had a shallow trench running through and was probably once filled with water. Right now, however, it was bone dry.
"What's an R.O.U.S.?"
her ignorant master replied.
"Doesn't sound very tasty."
"Not particularly tasty, no,"
the succubus confirmed without skipping a beat.
"They're basically horse-sized rats or mice. I think one of them's a chipmunk, actually."
"So, monsters?"
"Indeed, master."
"Nice.
It was an unwritten law of this world that a high enough concentration of ambient magical energy would, in time, give birth to the aberrant creatures called monsters. The excess mana would either mutate existing, normally harmless animals, draw in magical beings from afar, or bring inanimate objects and substances to life. Regardless of the method, the end result was always the appearance of monsters. The large termites that plagued the surrounding hilt trees were perfect examples of this phenomenon. In other words, the presence of these rodents of unusual size was a sure sign that the area around this section of the tunnel was likely dense in ambient mana. Just the sort of thing that Zira and Korra were looking for down here. And also the likely reason why these tunnels were shut down in the first place. A monster infestation took decades, maybe even centuries, to set in, but was near impossible to completely clear out after that point. The government had likely decided to cut their losses and seal off the vermin while taking the opportunity to renovate the city's plumbing infrastructure.
"How's the mana density?" Boxy asked.
"I can't sense it."
Zira was both a demon and a pyromancer, which made her naturally sensitive to the intangible and normally invisible substance known as mana. However, she lacked her master's perceptiveness in that regard, so she couldn't pick up on magical signatures that were too faint. Which also meant that the mana around this place was not thick enough to serve as nourishment for the shapeshifter's dungeon core.
"I see. Keep searching and find the source," Boxy commanded.
"Understood, master."
"So, we're going in deeper, right?"
Korra asked while scraping rat blood off the soles of her boots. The six R.O.U.S. were a total joke in terms of actual strength and would completely splatter with just the lightest kick. It wasn't enough to sate her thirst for violence, so she was eagerly looking forward to smashing more of the filthy vermin.
"That's right,"
confirmed Zira.
"Let's check out the direction these things came from."
The dynamic, demonic duo kept advancing through the ruined tunnels and clearing out the odd pack of R.O.U.S. They couldn't tell if the mana density in the air was getting weaker or stronger, so they mostly just looked for large concentrations of the overgrown rodents. It took them a few hours, but they eventually made another promising discovery. The tunnel they were in was sealed off completely due to a wall of mossy bark.
"Master,"
Zira reached out telepathically,
"I think we found the source of the monsters down here. There's a gigantic tree root poking through the side of the tunnel, and it has a huge hole in the side of it that's leaking a good amount of mana from inside."
"Inside?"
"Yes, master. It's hollowed out, and there seems to be a tunnel leading up into the tree's interior."
Boxy quickly thought back to all the things it had learned from the elves during its stay in the city, especially concerning those trees' unique biology. It was highly likely that this hole and tunnel were made by a termite colony. If a nest was nearby, then this would be a huge chance for it to obtain the lair it wanted. Well, the place still had to be scouted out, as it wasn't completely sure whether this was actually the case.
"How wide is the hole?"
The succubus looked at the narrow opening that was barely a meter in diameter. The circular wooden tunnel inside wasn't much wider.
"Big enough for me or you to squeeze through, but the meathead will probably get stuck."
"Go in and investigate it. Let me know if you find a termite nest. Arms will stand by outside the entrance in case I need to use transfamiliar."
"Understood, master."
Zira sighed in dissatisfaction as she climbed into the tight passage, while Korra grumbled at the fact she was being made to stand around doing nothing again. They would follow their orders, but that didn't mean they had to like them. Neither of the two demons were keen to stick around these tunnels any longer than they had to, and both of them were quite sure that this task would have been completed a lot sooner if their master actually helped. However, Boxy had no intention of personally coming down there unless it was absolutely necessary. This wasn't because it was being lazy or somehow felt that trudging through ruined sewers was somehow beneath it. It was just busy raising its doppelganger job at the moment, and the method it was using didn't leave it with a lot of opportunities to go skulking about in a sewer. At least, not quite yet. The thing about doppelgangers was that they were infiltrators, which was why Boxy's actions prior to leaving Bootlick 3 weeks ago gave it far fewer levels than expected. Although the monster still thought of itself as a mimic, which was to say a creature that lived to prey on humans and other enlightened beings, this was no longer the case. Even though it still had its old job and most of its chest-bound instincts remained intact, its species and main job had both changed to a doppelganger's. Once it thought about it more deeply, the monster realized that doing the same things it did prior to its rank up and expecting the same outcome was a mistake. The truth of the matter was that not all jobs progressed through combat. An alchemist raised their level by brewing potions. A laborer would do the same through intensive labor, such as hauling cargo, digging ditches, and chopping wood. A bard would sing songs, play instruments, and tell stories. The doppelganger job was also among these non-combatants, requiring that the monster live among people as one of their own rather than ambush, kill, and eat them as a mimic would. Hunting alongside other apprentice rangers, conversing with people at the market, or just shaking hands with someone it met for the first time, any and all social interactions with the unsuspecting elves contributed towards the monster's next doppelganger level. It was a steady stream of XP that meant it could get stronger as long as it maintained its cover. Well, that wasn't to say that it would suddenly become a pacifist. Being a monster meant that doppelgangers still thrived on bloodshed and carnage somewhat, even if it wasn't the correct way to raise the job's levels. Besides, even if it could sate its hunger by filling up on termites or a hilt fruit, the former mimic still wanted to dine on people. Eating tasty things was still more or less its main goal in life, so it saw no reason to avoid chowing down on people whenever possible. Those opportunities were few and far between, as Boxy didn't really have the option to skulk around in the sewers or back alleys looking for dinner. It had to work hard if it was to establish an identity, forge relationships, and earn the trust of others. Doing so would allow it to gain doppelganger levels much faster than if it simply hid in a dark corner somewhere and only came out in order to buy or sell things. The more people it fooled, the more XP it would earn. It was therefore important to stand out just enough to leave a favorable or lasting impression, but not too much so as to raise suspicion. Walking that fine line was quite challenging and had to be done carefully. Even if Boxy felt like a wolf hiding among sheep, a lot of those sheep were heavily armed and more than a few of them were considerably stronger than the wolf. Honestly speaking, the creature never thought it would find itself in such a position. If someone had told Boxy's past self that it would end up with social obligations, it would have stabbed them in the face and eaten them. Granted, it would have probably tried to do that anyway, but it would have done so much more maliciously. And yet it had spent an entire week talking to people without trying to eat them. It couldn't really complain, though. It had already gotten up to level 13 of its doppelganger job, despite doing relatively little fighting or murdering. Its schedule was a bit too full for that at the moment, but this was bound to change when it graduated from Fayhorn's ranger class. After that, it would have a lot more free time to focus on its artificer job or just enjoy its ever-growing collection of shiny things. It was also to that end that it really wanted to establish a lair and use the dungeon core as a sort of security and home management system.
"Master,"
called out Zero once again.
"I think I found the nest."
Something which looked like it would happen sooner rather than later. Part 5. Zira had spent a good half hour climbing up the narrow passage inside the hilt tree's root. Thankfully, it got a bit wider as she got higher up, though not wide enough to let her spread her wings and fly up it. Eventually, it stopped going upwards and evened out a bit, allowing her to crawl rather than climb. She really had no idea what her position relative to the ground was, as her entire world consisted of nothing but the chewed-up walls of a lumber tunnel. A few minutes later, the tight passage opened up into the side of a large, hollowed-out chamber that was vaguely cylindrical. It was mind-bogglingly tall, as it went so far straight up that she couldn't even see the top. As for the shape itself, it was irregular, to say the least. The termites had eaten away at the insides of the mighty tree with reckless abandon, leaving the walls of this tall cavern riddled with numerous ridges, cliffs, and caves. In fact, the passage that Zira was currently poking her head out of was only one of what appeared to be hundreds of tunnels lining the walls of this space. Looking down from her tiny perch, she saw the uneven bottom of the hollowed-out tree trunk some 40 or 50 meters below. She assumed the bottom was down there, but she couldn't actually see it. Hundreds of large insects crawled all over it, completely hiding the ground floor from view. The walls surrounding the succubus were also thick with what she now estimated to be thousands of the creatures. The seasoned succubus cast her gaze farther upwards and noted that, thankfully, the writhing mass of termites did not extend all the way up to the top of this place. The extra-large colony appeared to have been steadily eating their way downwards over the course of a long time, so the vast majority of the swarm was concentrated here. The succubus wasn't sure what her current altitude was, but she had a sneaking suspicion these guys had started at the very top of the tree.
"Master, I think I found the nest," she reported with a hint of sarcasm.
"Can you take care of it yourself?"
"Probably, but are you sure? I mean, using fire in a cave made out of wood is a little..."
"It'll be fine. That timber is resistant to magic, so it won't catch fire. The elves do this sort of thing all the time."
"Understood. What about the enemy? There's quite a lot of them, you know."
"So?"
"So, wouldn't they be good fodder for your job levels?"
"Those termites are way too pathetic. I'd just be wasting my time on them."
If one were to kill something that was much, much weaker than themselves, then they would get practically no combat XP. There was nothing to be learned from stomping on a few defenseless ants, which was exactly what this would equate to, if Boxy did things personally. Okay, maybe this particular hive counted as more than a few, but that was beside the point.
"What about your ranger job?"
That one was a different story altogether. Since the ganger's newly acquired ranger job was still relatively low level, it was bound to go up significantly with this much prey.
"Can't let it grow too quickly. Otherwise that Fayhorn guy will realize something's up."
As expected of a seasoned elf ranger, he had sharp intuition and easily spotted things that were out of place. Boxy had to hold back immensely whenever that guy was around, and performing down to those other apprentices' level was surprisingly difficult. However, the monster learned quite a bit by doing so. It was ironic, in a way. Fayhorn's teachings about being able to control one's power to the utmost were intended as a way to maximize an adventurer's effectiveness when fighting monsters. Yet, a monster in his care was applying that approach in order to minimize its power in an attempt to blend in completely with a group of trainee adventurers. And it seemed to work beautifully. Though a welcome boon, that control training hadn't been why Boxy enlisted as a ranger. It wanted to be one because those nimble hunters were unmatched when it came to stalking, tracking, pursuing, and cornering a target. Not only that, but it was a job that benefited greatly from the monster's already high dexterity and agility attributes. The bow was also a very useful and versatile weapon. Even if it lacked the destructive power of spells and required expendable ammunition, it was perfectly silent and had a far greater range. One could also use special arrowheads to produce spell-like effects. For instance, a forward-thinking shapeshifter might use its artificer job to create explosive projectiles that detonated on impact. The weight and weird shape of the arrow would greatly diminish its accuracy, but that wasn't much of a problem considering it could just fire it into a crowd and have the shrapnel do the rest.
"So I should take them on by myself?"
Zira asked for confirmation.
"That's right."
If the summoned familiar were to take them out, then there would still be some improvement regarding Boxy's warlock job. That particular occupation could grow as much as it wanted, since spell-related attributes and skills had no way of interfering with a thoroughly non-magical bow and arrow. It also had no intention of revealing its identity as a warlock to others. At least, none of the people knew its identity as a ranger. It still didn't have to go down there personally. A termite's weakness was fire, and its favorite snack, who had currently grown to a level 39 succubus and level 28 pyromancer, was more than suited to the task at hand.
"Wipe them out,"
it ordered.
"Yes, master,"
she replied with an oddly enthusiastic voice. The succubus did not particularly enjoy violence like a certain four-armed sex friend of hers, but she did have an intense desire to set the world on fire. And while making the literal world go up in flame was beyond her means, Turning these blissfully unaware insects' reality to ashes was the next best thing. Her pyromaniac side hadn't been given a chance to shine in a long while, so being able to incinerate so many squishy things at once practically made her giddy. To begin with, she crawled out of the small tunnel she was in, spread her wings, and took flight. She snapped her fingers, causing her fake staff to appear out of nowhere and float idly next to her for a moment before she grabbed it out of the air. This wasn't really a magic item, but more of an empty shell she held onto out of habit. Gesturing with it while casting her pyroclasm spells just felt right. It was only natural to hold onto her long and hard thing while spraying a hot load all over. Zira cleared her throat in order to help rein in her errant thoughts and focused on the task at hand. The termites were bound to notice her presence soon, so she had to take advantage of the element of surprise. She floated down to the bottom and pointed her imitation staff towards the writhing mass of insects beneath her and activated one of her pyromancer skills.
Summon Molten Guardian!
An intense red glow flashed for an instant within the crawling abyss, followed by an explosion of molten rock and flames. Numerous termites were sent flying everywhere as the Molten Guardian quite literally erupted from beneath them with a deep roar. It was a fearsome creature in the vague shape of a 1-meter-tall lizard. Its thick torso and short, pudgy legs consisted of black, smoldering rocks with red-hot molten lava dripping slightly from the gaps between them, giving off the bizarre appearance of blood vessels filled with liquid fire. Its long, thick tail and short, flat face were pure fire given form. It had a row of white-hot stone spikes running along its back, right where its spine would be, if it had one of those.
Get him, Smokey!
The Molten Guardian obeyed with a roar as it leapt into the swarm that had noticed too late there was an intruder in their nest. However, their instincts were torn between repelling the intruder and not getting roasted alive, so the termites had fallen into disarray. Smokey wasn't going to give them a choice in the matter, though. Its fiery jaws and tail, burning claws, and incinerating breath washed over the defenseless creatures with the heat of a miniature volcano. Smoke, steam, and disgusting juices flew everywhere as the pests quite literally popped open en masse from the intense heat.
Flamethrower!
A cone-shaped torrent of flames erupted from Zira's staff at her call, bathing the chamber's wall in an almost literal sea of fire. There was an ear-wrenching, squeaking hiss as dozens of termites burned to a crisp in a matter of seconds. Their flaming bodies fell down to the ground, causing Zira's devouring flames to spread even further. Noticing the airborne threat, the insects attempted to leap off the walls and latch onto the succubus. At least this was a target they could sink their mandibles into. Or so they thought.
Blast wave!
A pulse of intense heat erupted from the winged demon, sending the termites who were about to envelop her flying in every direction while setting them ablaze. She turned her attention to another section of the wall and doused it in a flamethrower spell, followed by another blast wave. She then threw her trademark inferno spell towards the ground, right on top of the rampaging Molten Guardian. Rather than being harmed by the roaring tornado of flames, the lava lizard actually absorbed them into itself, causing it to grow slightly in size. It gave off a gut-wrenching roar before flying into yet another bug-stomping spree, only this time with much more speed and ferocity. A Molten Guardian was an elemental, a mindless golem-like construct conjured out of raw mana. This one in particular had been imbued with a composite magic that was attuned to both earth and fire. Much like other summoning-type skills, it was a manifestation of the caster's magical power. It fed off magical flames in order to momentarily grow stronger and was impervious to physical attacks, but the downside was that its summoner had to constantly supply it with MP to sustain it. Even Zira's impressive capacity of nearly 4,000 MP would only allow it to exist for about 6 or 7 minutes before she ran dry. This raised a troubling question. The succubus looked at her surroundings, carefully gauging how much of the pests she and Smokey had managed to clear out.
Slow. Too slow,
she complained to nobody in particular. No matter how many termites were squashed or burned, more of them just kept pouring in from the tunnels that lined the walls. They kept coming, seemingly without end. Even if they were pathetically weak, there were just too many of them. If things carried on like this, she'd run out of MP before she could deal with all of those critters. The staggering amount of work it would take to fully clean up this place made her wish this blasted tree would just explode already.
Yeah, that's a thing I could try,
she mumbled. An idea had formed in her mind while she stared upward. It was a stupid idea, but one that might just work, given the size of the place. She was also sure to enjoy the outcome, even if it was a failure, so she decided it was worth a try. She lowered her altitude and touched down on the charcoal-like ground. She gave the order for Smokey to keep those things away from her and started chanting. It was a long incantation, one that went on for about 8 seconds before she finished it.
Meteor!
The top of the impossibly tall cavern lit up with a bright yellow light. As illogical as it was, a huge ball of molten rock that was at least 3 meters in diameter fell through the air, directly towards the succubus and her summoned pet.
Wow, that worked.
She honestly felt surprised at this outcome. Although incredibly powerful, the meteor spell had quite a few problems with usability. The MP cost was high, both the incantation and the delay before it hit were long, and it required a lot of headroom in order to pull off successfully. Trying to use it indoors would normally result in the spell failing the caster's body apart due to the magical backlash. This was rather disappointing, as the extreme masochist really needed some intense stimulation. But even if she succeeded in casting the spell due to the hollowed-out cavern's absurd proportions, it still wouldn't do much in the grand scheme of things. Sure, it would completely annihilate 30 or 40, maybe even 50 of the damned bugs, but that was a huge waste of magical power. A flamethrower or inferno spell would be far more efficient, but calling down this miniature sun was merely the first part. Zira pointed her staff directly at the rapidly approaching ball of death and activated yet another skill, one that let her detonate any of her pyroclasm spells while they were in mid-flight in order to massively increase their area of effect.
Volcanic burst!
In the next instant, the mass of molten rock and flames exploded violently. Bright red and yellow debris spread in every direction, bathing the insides of the colossal hilt tree in flaming plumes of liquid lava. Hissing and popping noises could be heard from all over as the wriggling walls were coated in Zira's magical flames, which clung incessantly to everything and anything they touched. What Voxy said earlier was the truth. Hilt trees were quite resistant not only to physical trauma, but magic in general. That was why buildings and gear made of their iron bark were considered extremely durable, despite being made of wood. This trait also allowed the elves to purge termite nests they found with flames without fear of burning the trees. It took significant effort to set these things ablaze, and if that were to actually happen, then the mana-suffused material would burn with a heat that no other living thing could muster. This was precisely what was going on around Zira. Her especially stubborn flames managed to ignite the insides of the hilt tree, rapidly turning it into a furnace. The cavernous space had plenty of air, too. If left alone, the magic-fueled flames would surely spread and consume the entire tree in a matter of minutes. The perpetrator herself didn't seem to actually care, though. Her manic laughter echoed through the blazing chamber, accompanied by the crackle and pop of hundreds of termites losing their lives each second. She didn't even notice that she was being burned by her own magic, nor would she care even if she did. She was engrossed by the wondrous sight of being surrounded by flames, smoke, and ashes on all sides. It was as if reality itself was set ablaze, and she loved every single moment of it.
Snack! What did you do?
Boxy's sudden communication broke the succubus out of her reverie. Her master sounded less than pleased, to say the least. and now that she had partly regained her composure, Zira realized that it had good reason to do so.
I went a bit overboard.
A bit? I can see the smoke from out here. Put it out right away.
Even if you tell me that... Oh, right! Smokey!
The Molten Guardian that was busy mopping up the few surviving bugs on the ground stopped what it was doing and ran back to her side. It stood at attention, ready to receive new orders.
Eat all of the fire in here,
the succubus commanded. The flat-faced lava lizard turned its stare to the roaring tower of fire. It then looked at its summoner, then back up, then back to Zira once more. It was as if it was trying to say, Are you kidding me with this shit? Even if one could theoretically order a minion to drink up the entire ocean or leap up into the stars, impossible things were impossible. And it was impossible for a single molten guardian to consume a mountain of flames seemingly hundreds of times larger than itself, something the succubus realized moments later.
Don't question me, just fucking do it!
She demanded. The wholly unsentient and completely mindless molten guardian rolled the bright red flames of its eyes as it ran towards the edge of the chamber and started climbing up the burning wall. It sucked in all the flames that blocked its path as it made its way upwards, but the charred embers it left behind reignited mere seconds later. The succubus would have more luck trying to put this raging inferno out by squirting her lewd juices all over it. Zira was just desperate enough to try that ludicrous idea, because it was the only one she had. The last thing she wanted was to let down her beloved master. It was hardly the first time she'd messed up, and Boxy had gotten angry with her many times in the past. Things had always more or less worked out for her, but this would probably be the first time her master would be disappointed in her, and that thought was difficult to stomach. If asked to put that strange feeling into words, the succubus would probably reply that it was not tasty. The succubus passed out moments later. Well, as close to passing out as she could get considering her high mental attribute. She still clung to consciousness and perceived the burning inferno around her, her body no longer listening to her. Even if her flesh was born of magic, she still needed to breathe just like any other living being, and the thick and heavy smoke in the air made that quite difficult to do. She collapsed while choking on the byproducts of her own magic, a faint smile on her lips. Even under these circumstances, the relentlessly rotten part of her looked forward to the sweet agony of her skin being consumed by the flames. Just then, she heard a noise. A thunderous roaring sound coming from the smoke-obscured air above her came down on her at a frightening speed. It was so loud that it effortlessly drowned out the crackling of the flames. The succubus couldn't even guess as to what could be making it. That mystery didn't last long, as a literal waterfall came crashing down on her. The sudden deluge of foamy water completely and entirely quenched the flames, putting them out in an instant. It swept away the molten guardian that was still trying to follow its impossible orders, extinguishing it like a match in a typhoon. The barely conscious succubus was flabbergasted. Well, the good news was that the tree her master wanted to use wouldn't burn down from her ineptitude. Plus, she was no longer choking. The bad news was that she was now drowning instead. Her limp body was tossed back and forth as the turbulent current settled itself. She no longer knew which way was up or down, nor did she have a method of finding out. And yet, despite taking in so much water, her body outright refused to die. You are suffocating. HP minus 364. You have bathed in the waters of life. HP plus 500. You are suffocating. HP minus 364. You have bathed in the waters of life. HP plus 500. You are suffocating. HP minus 364. You have bathed in the waters of life. HP plus 500. It would appear this strange liquid was also magical in nature. It had restorative properties on par with high-grade healing potions, but none of the toxicity that led to potion sickness. Or at least, that's how it seemed to Zira. She wasn't all that familiar with the condition in question, but she didn't experience any weird side effects. The only odd thing she registered after spending 3 or 4 minutes drowning in the green-tinted liquid was a peculiar sense of familiarity, as if she'd done this many times before. She didn't get to explore that feeling before the stuff started draining away as suddenly as it had appeared. With the water levels receding, the succubus found herself sputtering up water while crawling on all fours atop a small outcropping of timber. She looked around her to find that, much to her surprise, the wooden insides of the tree were not charred or burned in the slightest. In fact, the wood actually seemed to be healthier than ever as the jagged, bug-eaten surface was covered in healthy, strong bark with white and yellow flowers growing from it. The mysterious flood of these so-called waters of life not only quenched the fire, but completely healed and reinvigorated the tree.
Good morrow unto you, madam.
An eloquent voice coming from above reached Zira's ears. The succubus dumbly looked upwards to see a green-skinned woman with long, flowing vines for hair poking halfway out of the rejuvenated wooden ground directly in front of her. Her ears were pointed like an elf's, and she had a pair of antler-like growths jutting out of the top of her head. Her breasts were even more bountiful than Zira's, although they were wrapped in leaves and vines that kept her somewhat decent. Her beautiful face bore a green-lipped smile that exuded a sense of class and dignity.
What?
The succubus responded, struck dumb by the unfamiliar creature's appearance.
Grant thee mercy for chasing those insects' hints.
What?
She also had difficulty understanding that odd way of speaking.
I owe thee one.
The plant woman seemed to grasp her confusion and clarified herself with a small bow before disappearing into the bark. She sank into it as if it were the surface of a pond, complete with tiny ripples that expanded outwards from her. Though Zira was not going to complain that her potentially catastrophic fire had been put out, it would appear she would still have to deliver some bad news to Boxy. Namely that this tree already had a resident. Part 6. The 12 giant trees of Azure Vale were a species of magical plant known as Hilt, said to have been planted by the goddess Nairi herself. This was not actually the case, as they had been on this world since long before the deity in question came into existence, a living testament to nature's perseverance and endurance. So while the tree-hugging goddess did not create them, she most certainly blessed them. The combination of her divine power and this sparse forest's ancient, venerable magic caused a truly unprecedented reaction. A new type of existence had been born within each and every one of those colossal trees. The goddess's blessing had drawn out and given form to their primordial will, while the hilt's unique nature had bestowed it with life and meaning. It was thus that the beings known as dryads came to be. Although very little was known about them, they were largely believed to be spirits charged with the never-ending duty of protecting and nourishing the tree they had been born from. Truthfully, it was folly to think of a dryad and her hilt as separate entities. They were two parts of the same whole, and one could not survive without the other. The sacrilegious act of chopping or burning down a hilt tree would cause the death of the dryad, while separating the tree's spirit from its home by force would cause both of them to gradually wither and die. This was one of the many reasons why these plant-like women very rarely showed themselves to outsiders. Because of that, their existence was considered nothing more than myth and legend by the very elves that lived atop their branches and around their roots. There were, of course, select individuals that these reclusive beings showed themselves to, but they would need to have performed a considerable service to the tree for that to happen. This was probably why one of them presented herself to the strange winged woman that had helped rid her of that persistent termite problem. Although she was starting to regret that decision.
Come on out!
A loud shout echoed within the former termite's nest. Its source was a bizarre creature unlike anything else the dryad had seen before. Granted, She hadn't seen much since her kind typically remained blissfully unaware of the world at large, but she was still able to classify that thing as clearly abnormal.
I said get out here! I have to talk with you!
It wasn't because the magic user from earlier disappeared in a puff of smoke and was replaced by this thing. Teleportation magic was something the elves used quite a bit, so she already knew of its existence. It also wasn't because of this creature's strange appearance of a wooden treasure chest walking on 8 spider-like legs. Even if she was somewhat ignorant, the dryad still knew about mimics and what they were capable of. In fact, one could say that mimics were her offspring, given that it was her timber that the first of them had been born from, even if it had been a mortal elf who gave them life. What the dryad took issue with was the fact that this creature mimicked the appearance of a mimic, despite not being one itself. She had clearly seen its original humanoid form following its appearance, so she was completely baffled as to why it would take on such an odd shape. If it was just a simple box with legs, then she might humor it with an appearance. If it was a mindless beast, then she wouldn't particularly mind playing with it for a while, maybe even taking it in as a pet. It wouldn't be the first time she had done something like that. But that thought was far from her mind right now.
I know you're around here.
Whatever this thing was, it was clearly intelligent. Beings that showed intent in their actions were inherently suspicious, as they almost always had ulterior motives. This was why, even if she were to show herself to mortals, she did so very briefly. The ones who had seen her were usually awestruck. They considered themselves lucky and moved on with their lives. The event had inspired many of them to continue protecting her beloved tree or spreading her precious seeds. The rest of them, the individuals that stuck around and wanted to talk with her, always had selfish goals, and this one was no different.
If you don't show yourself, then I will assume you have no problem with me living here.
Wait, what? It wanted to live here? Inside of her? Was this thing nuts?
Okay, since you have no complaints, then I will just do as I please.
She had plenty of complaints, actually. Branches and roots were one thing, but dryads absolutely despised having other creatures inside themselves. After all, what living being would willingly welcome parasites? On the other hand, a single monster like this was nothing compared to the thousands of termites that were here beforehand, so she could probably put up with it. Besides, she doubted this thing was actually serious. It would probably get bored and leave soon enough anyway. That's when it opened a swirling black portal, and a clear crystal ball that was 50 centimeters in diameter fell out. The dryad had no idea what it was, but she had a bad feeling about it. One that was proven to be justified when it started sucking up all of the mana in the air like some sort of sponge. She needed that mana, especially since she just spent so much energy to douse that fire and heal her burns. Realizing that continuing to ignore this creature was probably a bad idea, the dryad decided she would need to make an appearance. Boxy had just taken the dormant dungeon core out of its storage and was looking for a good place to serve as the dungeon's heart when the wooden outcropping it was standing on started rippling like a puddle in the wind. A green, plant-like woman rose out of it as if something was pushing her out from beneath the surface. Her skin glowed with an eerie green light, chasing away much of the surrounding darkness. Her proportions were outrageously voluptuous, and her figure could easily rival that of a succubus. She was mostly naked, except for a series of leaves that covered the underside of her breasts as well as her pelvic area. This was obviously the resident that Snack mentioned earlier, and her emerald eyes showed that she was clearly not amused.
All right, let us speak,
she said in a deep, mature voice while crossing her arms under her outrageous cleavage.
What manner of business would thou have with one such as I?
You talk funny, Boxy noted.
Thy speech is the comical one from mine perspective,
she retorted.
I see.
I pray thee, put away thy profane object so that we may converse.
She pointed at the dungeon core that was already gathering up the ambient mana. It was something it started doing all on its own in order to test the environment and determine whether it would be suitable for establishing a dungeon. The mana density in this area wasn't quite as high as the core's former home, but it seemed to have determined that it would be sufficient. It was obvious that the shapeshifter's intention to claim this cavern as its dungeon lair would have to wait, so it obediently put it back inside its storage.
"Very good,"
commented the green woman.
"Now then, what dost thou need of me?"
"I want to live here," repeated Boxy.
"Truly?"
"Truly."
"Why?"
"It's convenient."
"How so?"
"It's safe, hidden, and is right in the middle of the city. I can hide my shiny things here while I'm out getting more shiny things, and I can work on my jobs and skills in peace."
"What dost thou mean by shiny things?"
Boxy momentarily opened its storage and took out several gold coins, then presented them to the dryad, using its tongue tentacle in lieu of a hand.
"Ah, 'tis gold?"
"Not just gold,"
the ex-mimic insisted. It then took out several other things from its collection. It showed off some sparkling gemstones, a few glowing rocks, several pieces of gilded silverware, a small silver statue of a knight, and even its prized mithril daggers. The plant lady seemed thoroughly unimpressed. She briefly raised an eyebrow when Boxy took out a jar of shiny juice, formerly known as honeydew, but didn't seem to care enough to comment about it.
"So, thou shalt not attempt to consume mine bark and branches?"
"No. Wood isn't very tasty. Fruits are okay, though."
"Then tell me, creature."
"Boxy."
"Pardon?"
"My name. It's Boxy. Boxy T. Morningwood."
"Oh? Thou hast a splendid name,"
she said with a hint of admiration.
"Thanks. I think so, too,"
the shapeshifter responded casually.
"Mine is Ambrosia, the dryad of this tree. 'Tis a pleasure to make thy acquaintance."
"Likewise."
The green woman seemed to relax a bit now that the formal introductions were out of the way. She behaved strangely like a person, even though she should technically be a monster, which meant that Boxy's recently acquired social skills were being put to surprisingly good use.
"So, Boxy, what be thy relation to the chill-challenged woman that cleansed mine insides from those hateful vermin?"
"That's Snack, one of my minions. She went overboard with the fire. So sorry about that."
It wasn't a sincere apology, of course. More of a formality.
"'Tis of no consequence, young one. Extreme measures were necessary to purge that infestation. It would have surely devoured mine whole being if left unattended. Therefore, I owe thee and thy servant mine thanks."
"Then I will gladly accept them. But how come you couldn't chase them out on your own? You should be able to do at least that much, right?"
The dryad's stoic expression gradually became one of sadness and shame.
"I am no longer able to defend myself from those creatures. I hath tried poisoning them, flooding them out, and trapping them in brambles. It worked the first few times, but those tenacious heathens always overcame mine attempts and returned stronger and more numerous. The power of fire remains their constant weakness, but I find myself unable to conjure flames by my own power. Eventually, I ran out of ways to fend them off, and found myself at their mercy."
"Such is the natural order of things,"
Boxy said sagely.
"'Tis so."
Those who did not adapt were devoured. It was the cruel truth of nature, something both parties understood firsthand.
"What about those waters of life you used earlier?"
"Ah, that substance is a mixture of the dew gathered from mine leaves and the sap from mine body."
"Don't suppose you can let me have some?"
"'Tis a simple matter, but would be of little use to thee as medicine,"
she cautioned.
"Thou art not the first to express interest in mine fluids. but one must fully submerge themselves in the waters of life in order to be healed. Simply drinking some will not accomplish much more than to satiate one's thirst, and its properties shall dissipate rapidly once removed from mine interior."
Boxy had expected this response. Of course, a literal waterfall of high-grade, toxicity-free healing potion would be too good to be true. Not to mention that it did already sample some of the stuff from the puddles that were strewn around the place. Although it was tasty, it showed absolutely no magical effects, just as she claimed. Since it was highly unlikely that it would be able to take a bath in the middle of a fight, this substance's practical usefulness was rapidly approaching zero. There ought to be some way to use this for profit, but such thoughts would have to wait until later. It still wanted to establish a dungeon within this tree, and judging from the way this dryad spoke, she was more than just a resident here. She was the owner. Perhaps even a manifestation of the tree itself, seeing as how she referred to it as her own body. Although it was unaware as to the true capabilities of her species, the avatar of a millennia-old magical plant was clearly not one to be trifled with. Boxy saw a way to obtain not only her permission in establishing a dungeon, but also her cooperation. Perhaps her servitude as well.
"So, about these termites. They'll come back, right?"
"'Tis so, young Morningwood. The biggest nest was cleared out due to thy servant's efforts, but 'tis hardly the only one. Could be in a month, a year, or a decade, but they shall return to full strength without fail."
"What if I told you I have a way for you to control those bugs?"
"Control, not exterminate?"
"That's right. Tell me, do you know what a dungeon is?"
"Dost thou mean the underground prisons those elves have built beneath mine roots?"
"No. Wrong type of dungeon. The one I'm talking about involves the... profane object you saw earlier."
The shapeshifter then spoke at length about what it had learned about dungeon cores over the past month or so. First, they had absorbed a certain amount of magical energy and attuned themselves to their magically enriched environment. After that, they had to be anchored in a magically affixed position, at which point the dungeon would be officially established and its territory could expand as long as the surrounding mana density permitted. All of that was controlled by the core's first basic function, dungeon expansion. The second one, item allocation, had to do with distributing rewards to any and all adventurers that managed to fulfill certain conditions. An example of this would be reaching a specific point in the dungeon in a set amount of time, defeating a tough enemy, or simply coming across a treasure chest. The items in question had to come through external means and would be stored within a pocket dimension bound to the dungeon core, similar to a mimic's storage. It was possible to forge items out of pure mana, but such things would disappear the instant someone tried to take them out of the dungeon. The monster didn't have any plans to use this function, nor did it have any idea why anyone would willingly give out treasures. It was like breaking into someone's house, killing their dog, and having the residents happily cook and serve the poor animal to the intruder. However, it took this opportunity to point out that it was possible to create temporary or single-use magic items with which one could fend off intruders. One of said items was a rod of fire, which produced a flamethrower-like effect at will. The third basic function was mana collection. This allowed the dungeon core's owner to regulate the rate at which the surrounding mana was absorbed. Maintaining the dungeon's various functions required MP as fuel, and not all of it could be recycled. Even if it would eventually come back on its own, it was important to properly manage this resource in order to keep all of the dungeon's facilities running. It was also important to the dryad that the magical energy in question was something she needed in order to sustain herself and her hilt tree. However, the basic function that really caught her attention was the fourth one. The monster spawner menu could be used to determine the type of monsters that appeared inside the dungeon and could exert a certain amount of control over them. Meaning, it was entirely possible to gain dominion over those simple-minded termites and order them to kill themselves en masse. If not, there was also the option of spawning some of their natural predators in order to control and contain their spread. perhaps wipe them out completely. The fifth function, the surveillance net, was the one Boxy wanted to take advantage of the most. It collected information regarding everything that happened within the Dungeon Core's sphere of influence. It was possible to appraise any and all intruders and their gear. Not to mention, it would automatically log their progress through the dungeon. Most importantly, it could instantly notify the shapeshifter should any unauthorized individuals try to encroach on its stash of shinies. Well, that wasn't to say that the individual directly in front of it wasn't suspicious, but she seemed genuinely disinterested in its collection. There were also 5 advanced features to a dungeon core, although those demanded a much larger amount of MP to operate compared to the basic ones. Guardian assignment allowed the appointment of extra powerful monsters to guard key junctions. Again, something Boxy had no interest in actually putting to use. Nexus access, on the other hand, was a curious one that not only allowed the core's owner to instantly teleport anywhere within the dungeon, but could also transport them to any other dungeons that might be under their rule. Prison management was there in case Boxy wanted to keep certain individuals alive for extended periods of time. It would provide them with a living space and cater to their basic needs using magic. There was also the matter of the ominously named interrogation room that could be built and maintained through the prison management menu. Next up was terrain sculpting, a feature that would allow the dungeon's owner to change the layout of their dungeon at will. It was unclear as to whether a living mass of timber would count as terrain, but there was a good possibility that it would. After all, that hedge maze and the spire of the Jade King was clearly plant-like in origin and could still benefit from the dungeon's auto-repair feature, courtesy of terrain sculpting. This was also the thing that maintained the warped space inside the spire itself, which opened up a lot of interesting possibilities. The final advanced feature was trap construction, which was the one Boxy looked forward to experimenting with the most. Teleportation circles, spiked floors, poisonous gas, trap doors, swinging guillotines, crushing ceilings, anti-air countermeasures. All manner of deliciously devious devices could be built in an instant. The former mimic was particularly eager to see what those booby-trapped chests were like.
How wondrous!
The dryad exclaimed once Boxy finished its presentation. Her face lit up with joy.
If this dungeon core is truly as powerful as thou claim, then I would no longer have to worry about any pests nibbling at mine bark, or sensitive heart would.
It's only as powerful as the mana in the environment, reiterated Boxy. But inside here should prove to be more than enough to handle some pesky bugs. So, how about it, Ambrosia? I will establish a dungeon inside this chamber, and you can be my... It's Dungeon Master.
A Dungeon Master?
She asked dubiously.
What doth that entail?
You get to control all of the basic functions I told you about, but only I get to play around with the advanced ones.
So, like a steward?
That's one way to put it.
Are there any other limitations?
You, or rather, the part of you I'm speaking to, would need to remain inside the dungeon's boundaries at all times.
I hath no intent to venture beyond mine bark, so that is agreeable.
Also, I will have supreme authority within the dungeon since I'm the core's owner, but I'll mostly leave you to do your thing.
Her eyelids twitched slightly at that first bit. Well, saying someone else would be the supreme authority of part of her body was understandably not to her liking. However, she didn't deny the offer outright.
What if thou were to perish?
Then I suppose you would become the owner.
Oh? Thou art rather forthcoming with such sensitive information.
I'm not even 6 months old. Assuming I would outlive someone as ancient as you is a stupid notion.
I suppose so.
So, what do you say? If we team up, then you can manage your pest problems under your own power, and I have a hideout to use as I see fit.
I must say, 'tis a very tempting proposition.
Ambrosia closed her eyes and thought. She didn't particularly mind having this creature called Boxy take up residence inside her tree, not when it offered this much rent in return. Of course, she would have to give up a certain amount of her food in order to maintain this dungeon it wanted to make. But it wasn't that big a deal. The mana coursing through this cavern only accounted for about a quarter of the total she pulled up from deep beneath the ground. That said, the consumption would need to be regulated. She could still survive even if that strange crystal ball sucked up every last drop of it, although she wouldn't be able to produce her fruits and spread her seeds.
I just have one more inquiry.
Countless numbers of vines sprouted from the ground beneath Boxy and wrapped around it in an instant. They completely bound the creature and tightened their grip on its faux wood shell as if threatening to squeeze the life right out of it. Numerous sharp brambles dug furiously into its skin, causing its dark red doppelganger blood to ooze out of the wounds.
What's to stop me from crushing thee right here and now, and claiming this dungeon core for mine own?
The dryad asked with a clearly hostile attitude.
Right back at you.
Dozens of short steel blades suddenly sprouted from the fake mimic's surface, cutting apart the plants that had entwined themselves around it. After breaking free, the creature rapidly grew in size many times until it became a 3-meter-tall imitation of the demonic overlord called Magnamore, complete with armor and glaive, courtesy of metal mimicry.
What's to stop me from ripping this tree apart and having my minion burn it to the ground?
It even spoke with the same deep, booming voice, although the non-flaming skull meant it didn't have nearly the same impact as the original.
Do not presume to treat me like one of those idiotic bugs,
it roared. The dryad did not even flinch at the obvious threat and otherwise terrifying demonic appearance. Rather than being intimidated, she actually broke into a large smile and stared ferociously at it. Each of them gave off a malicious, dry laugh while staring the other down and baring their fangs, literal or otherwise. In the end, both of them were monsters. So what if they were intelligent or appeared amicable? Ultimately, the only thing that mattered to either was themselves, and they would not hesitate to kill in order to fulfill their selfish desires.
Very well, Boxy T. Morningwood. This one shall agree to thine bargain.
Looking forward to working with you, Ambrosia.
But that didn't mean they couldn't compromise. Boxy would have to share its living space with this plant woman, but it didn't particularly mind since it would mean added security. The dryad, on the other hand, would receive the means by which to exterminate everything and anything she deemed as pests, but had to agree to serve as this creature's host. Both of them stood to profit immensely if they worked together, whereas the only thing violence and hostilities would earn them was massive injuries.
Well then, declared Boxy while reverting to its preferred chesty form. I'll go find a good spot to form the dungeon's heart.
Having obtained the dryad's consent, the doppelganger once again took out the dungeon core from storage. Much like before, the crystal orb immediately began sucking in the ambient magical energy at a staggering rate. After about 5 minutes, it had grown back to its initial size of about 1 meter in diameter and gave off a bright yellow light, almost like a miniature sun. By the time it finished charging up, Boxy had scouted a prime location within this cavernous nest. It had ultimately decided to use a fairly flat and considerably wide wooden plateau as the dungeon's innermost sanctum. It stood in the middle of it and held the now-charged dungeon core above its head.
Dungeon expansion! Create dungeon!
The core's yellow shine brightened as it responded to its owner's command. It rose steadily into the air, climbing to an altitude of about 7 meters above its owner. It then sprouted 8 thick chains made of solid white light, which stretched out and waved around like drunken serpents. 2 of them latched onto the floor, 3 onto the surrounding walls, and 3 more to the air itself. Once all of them were in place, they gradually faded from view as the core became firmly affixed to that one spot. The crystal orb then let out a massive wave of mana that washed over its surroundings. It was a burst of magic thick enough to make both Boxy and Ambrosia wobble on their feet. Congratulations! Your dungeon has been established. Please state the name of this dungeon.
Dryad's Domain,
it spoke aloud, and the core flashed two times in response. The Dryad wondered what that was about, but got her answer in the next instant. You have now entered Dryad's Domain.
Appoint Dungeon Master, Ambrosia.
Dryad's Domain has recognized you as its rightful ruler. Do you wish to claim ownership of this dungeon? Yes or no?
Oh, how flattering,
she said dryly while selecting the yes option in her head. Ambrosia has been appointed as the Dungeon Master of Dryad's Domain.
What is? Boxy asked curiously.
Thou named it after myself.
It's not flattery. It's misdirection.
Misdirection? How so?
If someone comes here, I want them to think you're in charge.
I am in charge.
Of course you are. I merely meant that I don't want my presence to be known.
I see. So, how do I actually control this thing?
Just say, Dungeon Management. You can probably figure it out.